101.9.
It's the Profiling Sam Harris edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Global Heritage Equality, Jesus T-shirt, Day of Reason, and Sam Harris on Profiling. Let's begin episode 165.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks, though. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan, I am just out of breath. Oh, there was such a big thing in the news, I just ran here to try and get it on the air as quick as we can.
And that would be?
Okay. There's been a number of important elections this weekend, and none of them were in the U.S., so I'm not going to rant about that. France rejected austerity and defeated Sarkozy by electing socialist candidate Hollande. So France elected Hollande as their president. Sorry if you see the M.
Yeah, it's good.
The number three candidate was the National Front, who garnered almost 18% in the first round of voting compared to the now-elect president, Hollande, who gained 28%. Another major election was in Greece. This was noteworthy because of the ongoing economic catastrophe, both internal and the effects it could have on Europe as a whole. Many people are now prophesizing the dissolution of the economic union in Europe. The pro-austerity parties, one left, one right, failed to gain a majority. However, what was more ominous was who did win in that election, and win in quotes. One party, the extremist Golden Dawn Party, which rejects the neo-Nazi label, which of course is always the first time that you are a neo-Nazi,
yeah,
and insists that it's a national and patriotic party. Nonetheless, as they say, it's a neo-Nazi party. They have a swastika kind of thing on their flag. They do the whole Heil Hitler sort of salute. This movement has been blamed for a lot of violent attacks on immigrants and ran on an anti-immigrant platform, vowing to clean up Greece and calling for landmines to be placed along the border. Now, you know, you got to give them credit here. The Americans, they just want to build a wall. Greece, they want to blow the shit out of people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. You can't call yourself not a neo-Nazi party and do the Heil Hitler salute. I think that's a law.
Yeah, no, and in some parts of Europe
it is.
actually, the party leader promised after getting their sort of victory that every immigrant, legal or not, would be kicked out. The idea that if you're not really Greek, you're out of here. Now, this party won 7% of the vote, and this is up from their previous count, which was 0.3%. They gained 21 seats in the parliament. This sort of coincides with another sort of larger, darker trend. Hollande had electoral gains for the Party of Freedom, most noteworthy for the infamous Geert Wilders. Denmark has its Dansk Folkeparti, People's Party, and others in Germany and England, which again has been sort of continuing this sort of trend of radical right movement, which for us is big because, well, we had the Norwegian terrorist who killed a bunch of people because he's worried about Islam. And because of the economic problems in Europe right now, it's easy to find a scapegoat. And people who aren't quite like you is easy. In North America, I think in a lot of ways we have some difficulties understanding this. I mean, we have racists here. But because we're a multicultural, multi-ethnic society sort of from day one, it doesn't strike us quite the same way as someone who is, like I say, French, and we've been French for 1,000 years, and that has a very different mindset.
Well, it also kind of really segues well into today's episode, because we're going to spend a good deal of time talking about the recent kerfuffle over Sam Harris and his recent comments about racial profiling. But, I mean, one of the big aspects of that whole conversation is going to be the notion of terrorism and where that terrorism is coming from. And in Europe, as you're mentioning, that terrorism is seen as a distinctly Islam origin of that terrorism, despite the fact that, you know, the Norway shootings was done by a very Christian man.
Well, and also, I think, goes to the point, and again, we'll probably talk about this later, about how in some ways other issues, again, in this case, economic issues, among other things, allows for sort of radicals to come up through the rafters and promote their hatred. And even though it may not be a rational hatred, it gains ground. Actually, one of the other things I thought was funny, the actual really big winner in the Greek election was a party called Syriza, which is a radical left-wing party. It gained 12 points to 17%, and it's now the number two leader in the Greek parliament with 52 seats. Now, was there ever a country in history that had a very strong, very radical leftist movement and a growing radical rightist movement, I don't know, 30s-ish, Central Europe?
Not that I recall, actually.
Oh, no?
I'm not very good at history, though.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. No, well, it's funny how history can repeat, because you had the same thing. Economic collapse with the Great Depression, and in Germany and other countries, Germany just was the big one, you had the Weimar Republic, where socialists, a lot of people don't remember, the Nazis won the battle, but the socialists, the communist parties were very, very strong, and there was this big struggle because of the underlying economic insecurity.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the whole post-war period after World War One was just a massive, I guess they could use the term, melting pot of different political theories. And no one really knew what theory was going to emerge as the dominant one. I mean, you had sort of communism, you had free market capitalism, and then you had those sort of weird quasi-nations like Britain that had a monarchy in one hand going, you know, oh my goodness, the world is falling apart.
Well, I think one thing too, and this is where, again, when we get to our talk about Sam Harris, among others, it'll play into, is that people often want to blame something. I mean, one of the common threads here is that your life is falling apart, society is falling apart, and you want to blame. The leftists and communists blame financiers, which are kind of an amorphous, I mean, you know they kind of exist, but you don't see them. Whereas the right and the Nazis, and I think the neo-Nazis in Greece here, are saying, you see that guy, the one with the brown hair and brown skin? He's the reason, and it becomes so much more easy to blame that person for all your other problems, irrespective of whether it's true or not.
Oh, absolutely. Which is one of the reasons why skeptics need to be very upfront with our political skepticism so that we can avoid that slippery slope into fascism.
And again, you know, at some point, some people may accuse us of being somewhat hypocritical because, you know, everyone knows I'm a very strong, very evangelical, fundamentalist sort of atheist. But at the same time, I think it's reticent upon myself to police my own. So if I see someone who's taking that sort of agenda to get rid of churches and are using it for other means, for example, racism or for oppression, then it is doubly reticent upon me to condemn that and to strike it down because in a way, in the same argument I use for religion, I am creating sort of that space for them to exist, right? Mm-hmm. I am being the radical, and what's the difference between their radical and my radical can be a very questionable thing, which is why it's important for me to say, no, you're wrong, and this is why you're wrong, and have a rational argument. In fact, I was talking to a friend of mine just a few minutes ago, and we were making a distinction between atheists and skeptics. And I think this is where some people, Pat Condell is a famous one on the internet, have shifted between being a good skeptic and being more of an atheist. But maybe we'll talk about that more later. I don't want to jump ahead in our topics a little bit more.
Fair enough.
Speaking of jumping ahead, let's go thousands of years in the past, which, I mean, if you've time is circular, that would be jumping ahead in a very...
Depends on your view of time-space.
Exactly. I was reading a report recently about from the Global Heritage Fund that named 10 sites facing irreparable loss and destruction. It was a report by Jeff Morgan, who was presented to the Asian Society. Quote, "We're looking at these millennial civilizations leapfrogging into the 21st century at a kind of pace that's unheard of and unprecedented," said Vishna Dell, president of the Asian Society. One of the things that's a big thing is you have these architectural gems in ancient Asia that are ancient and, you know, represent these really sophisticated cultures like the Khmer, etc. But they're facing really, really tough times because, you know, there's economic expansion. You're needing to build new factories and new homes. There's a lot of tourists now coming to these areas. And in some odd ways, the success is almost part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You also get things like, you know, just not a lot of technological resources. If you're sitting there and you're a government and you can either provide health care for some people living or you can provide security for some ancient monument, often the moral argument goes to providing the health care. And you also get things that, I mean, a lot of these areas go through cycles of up and down, and you get a lot of economic insecurity. And one way to do it is either you steal bricks and that to build your home from these sites, or you take the important artifacts and you sell them on the black market. Essentially, what this means is there's a large sort of decimation of a lot of these ancient artifacts. Experts said that global architecture preservation efforts are poorly coordinated and targeted. In fact, the UN cultural body, UNESCO, focuses almost entirely its efforts on wealthy European countries rather than places like Latin America and Asia. More than 80% of UNESCO's World Heritage Sites are located in the 10 richest states. Just for an example, and this is sort of, again, the good-bad story involved in this article I was reading. A place like Vat Pho in Laos, which is a very beautiful place to look at. It was pretty much unknown. And one of the downsides about being unknown is the forest that is taking over and gradually decomposing it through natural means. So they went in, the Global Heritage Fund went in, and they essentially rescued the site. They restored the road and the temple, and they started to develop tourism there. And the tourism went from about $12,000 a year to up to $250,000 a year. But again, this is where sort of the constant give and take needs to be, because now with all these tourists coming in, one, you have wear and tear on the monument, plus you get people who want to take a little souvenir home, and sometimes it's just a rock here or a brick there, but 200,000 bricks gone from an archaeological site, it's a pretty big thing.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Jeff Morgan, who was the author of these particular articles, said, there are examples in China where you have ancient temples, and then right next to them you have these high-rise buildings built to them. You're losing the cultural value of these sites. You're also losing their economic value. And of course, in about 10 years' time, we'll notice these things hugely because they will literally be gone from the landmark. Part of this, the reason why I brought this up, was one, it's important that we know about these things. I mean, it's a general knowledge. Two, and there'll be a link on our webpage to look at these things. I mean, from a historical standpoint, they're beautiful things to see. And the fact that these may be lost seems like such a tragedy. As some great person once says, he who forgets the past is condemned to relive it, or something like that.
Around those things, yeah.
But I also thought it was quite interesting is, I mean, we often promote the idea of conservation and all that, and how in some ways it's almost innately, well, prejudiced, racist, I'm not quite sure what the right word I'm looking for here. I mean, there are lots and lots of monuments in Europe, even in Canada here, that are being restored or being maintained, less so, thanks to the Harper government, but that's a whole other show. But because we have the resources, and then we tend to put blinders up for the rest of humans' heritage. I mean, that's the big thing. A lot of these sites, I mean, it's not Vietnamese culture, it's not Chinese culture, it's not African culture, it's human culture. And we all have a certain responsibility to protect our collective issues. I got into a lot of heck for one stance I had is I was a big supporter in the beginning of the American invasion of Afghanistan, but not for what everyone else was for, not because of 9/11 or terrorism or anything like that, but because one of the things the Taliban had done was destroy 12th century statues created by monks. They were like 20-foot statues. And I'm going, you bastards. I mean, you might not like that, and you might not care, but that's part of my heritage as well. We are all humans, and we're all united by that. And so, again, the takeaway is come to our website, look at these pictures, maybe go to some preservation site in the world, donate a dollar or two, and protect our common culture.
Oh, well said, Don. Let's go to a quick commercial break here on the show, and we'll be back with more here on Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So there's some, there's been a number of things that are causing waves in the free thought community, not just all over, but in Canada. And one of the things in Canada is a Jesus t-shirt.
Yes. Did you know your life is wasted? Apparently, according to one student, a grade 12 student was suspended from a school in Chester Basin, south of Halifax. And it is, as you say, sparked a bit of an outrage. William Swimner was sent home for a week after refusing to change out of a t-shirt that bared the religious message, "Life is wasted without Jesus." Now, some of the students had said, not everybody believes in Jesus. So I don't like when I saw, it was like saying, okay, so my life means nothing because, you know, I don't believe in him. Why should my life be wasted, right? So there was sort of like this, some people were taking slight offense to the t-shirt.
Sure.
The school official, apparently, like, they didn't suspend him because of his shirt. What they actually suspended him over is that he refused to take the shirt off when the principal asked him to take it off. So essentially it was sort of a power issue. You know, the principal says, hey, don't do this. And you go, screw you, I'm going to do it anyhow. And that was actually the instigation. The South Shore Regional School Board, a superintendent had said that, you know, if the shirt had read something like, "My life was wasted without Jesus," that would have been a much different situation. The school board had a press release, and they stated that, quote, "A student may choose to wear clothing that embraces their belief. However, it is expected the student will not wear clothing with the messages that will offend others' belief, race, religion, culture, or lifestyle. If a message can be reasonably interpreted by a person as negative towards that person's beliefs, religion, lifestyle, etc., and if it has offended other students or staff, the board feels that such instances are unacceptable and would ask the message in question be replaced by a message that clearly communicates the student's belief without disrespecting the beliefs or violating the rights of others."
I just had this thought. Imagine I was in this school and I was wearing like one of those like atheist t-shirts, and they were like, okay, you have to go either take your shirt off or come back with a shirt that reasonably explains why your atheist t-shirt shouldn't offend other people. I come back with the shirt, says, "I'm an atheist, but," and then just like, five-paragraph explanation of why I should be allowed to say that I'm an atheist and that why being an atheist should not offend religious people, even though it actually does.
But you see there, you did it. You said, "I am an atheist."
Yeah.
If you said, "If you're not an atheist, you're X." And that's where I think part of this had come into it. But you're right. I mean, is this simply a free speech issue? And in fact, CFI again sort of put its foot in it by coming out saying, "Oh, we defend the student for his free rights. We don't believe in religion, but you know, this is completely a free rights issue."
Well, in fairness, I did as well.
That's okay. You can be wrong.
I know, but
I'm not allowed to. Apparently, there's some cosmic law that prevents it. But
yeah, well, I've heard about this now.
But so like I say, it seems like there's more to this story than just a free speech issue. And thanks to EMB for bringing it to my attention, and I found out more. So apparently a 10th grader had said that, you know, a bit of the issue for her is, quote, "I think if our school is suspending him just based on the t-shirt, that'd be a problem. But if he's going around preaching to people, then that's a different problem." Many students apparently at the Forest Hill Community School have alleged that Swimner was doing just that. He was doing a lot of proselytizing. "Our innocent churcher was doing more than just wearing the slogan. Reports on the CBC have commented that others have told him that he's told kids that they're going to burn in hell if they don't confess their sins to Jesus. The student council vice president is, it started with him preaching his religion to kids and then telling them to go to hell, and a lot of kids didn't want to deal with this anymore." So again, it seemed like this was not really a free speech issue per se. It was
a proselytizing
harassment
issue. Yeah. Well, that's sort of where I would plead a sort of ignorance on this one. I mean, I wrote a blog post about this, and I kind of said along the lines of, listen, I mean, we can deplore this person's personal views. He may actually be a total jerk, and he kind of sounds like one. But he does have the right to express his jerkiness. Now, if he's going around harassing other students, that's when it crosses that line into bullying, and that's when there's an actual danger here. So, I mean, with that information, then that does change the dynamic of this conversation, because it stops really being about, I think, free speech becomes less of the concern, and now it's more of a concern of the proper venue that this person is in, a public school versus, you know, a church or wherever he would normally be doing his proselytizing.
Yeah, no, I agree. And actually, you bring up another thing, and this was sort of a secondary article that the CBC had, and I actually took quite a bit of an offense to it, even in the context of what you were thinking at the time, is that they had like six students that were promoting the rights of students. And I really didn't think he belonged to this particular group. The majority, which he represents, sort of, because I mean he's a Christian, he's white, cannot really claim to be suppressed like the other groups were. I mean, the vast majority of the people that were on this list were involved in bullying campaigns, LGBT issues, sexism, and real discrimination. The hijab issue, which again I have some controversies with, but I believe in a certain amount of equality.
And he did explicitly make the point that Christians were under attack and that he was the victim in all this, as has his family, as had his local religious authority made that case as well. So he is up on the cross, so to speak. He thinks of himself that way, at least.
Exactly. And I mean, like I say, when the CBC included him with this group, it was antithetical. Because again, you cannot really be an oppressed people if you are the majority and you're the ones in power. And unfortunately, Christians, and in this case, white Christians, are the majority. They are the ones who essentially are pulling the thing. And by pulling this, you know, I'm being oppressed card, was a bit of a, I don't, it was just a missed call. And again, as you point out, with limited information, quite often we can kind of make the wrong call on this. Although, again, from the beginning, I didn't like the way his shirt was sort of interpreted. No, let me take this back. The words themselves could be interpreted as offensive. And mm-hmm. one of the premises of the idea of hate crime, and maybe I'm blowing that up a little bit, is that if one person can interpret it as that, it makes it a plausible case.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, like I say, this wasn't like, you know, I don't believe in God, therefore I'm a nice person. It was like, you know, your life has no value. Mm-hmm. You know, there was sort of a more of a sinister image to this, which is where it gets the second ring of consideration. Again, must tread lightly, because as an atheist, how many times have we been accused of saying things that religious people find offensive, and we do that?
Well, I mean, one of the things that is also telling about this case is that I felt that the school's initial reaction to suspend him was a poor choice. I thought that their second idea of having an expert come in and talk about religious freedom and talk about how to have disagreements about faith. And I wasn't quite sure exactly who they were bringing in, maybe some kind of chaplain, I don't know. But I thought that that was actually a very good idea. I would have had a better idea, but I think it was a better move than just saying, you know, get out type thing. Then the student, after that was announced, the student was pulled out of class by his parents. And I think, you know, his pastor was involved in this as well, which I think to me really tells that this person wasn't interested in dialogue. They were purely interested in controversy and being a martyr. And I think that was really telling to me.
Well, and from what I understand, and again, so our knowledge about this is growing as it comes by, so hopefully I won't have to eat these words, but this was not like he pulled him out of school, but he had already pulled him out of other classes beforehand.
Yeah.
And so one has to question the value of education as it is when you get it in piecemeal, mm-hmm. and should parents be allowed to essentially dumbify their kids? But one of the things that I really wanted to bring up, and what I think is the biggest takeaway here, is I think the real cause of this issue is the constant attempt of those people to bring prayer into school, to use the educational system to propagate creationism in science classes, to expropriate school property for religious indoctrination and recruitment, that really it's been the efforts of the religious right that has created this sort of religion and school as a sensitive issue. I mean, if this had been almost anything else out there, it probably would not have been a big issue. But religion and schools are a hot topic issue, and it's become a hot topic issue because of the religious right. In essence, they created the ground for him to be kicked out. to a large degree, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if not, I mean, I don't want to speculate wildly, but I mean, it almost seems like that's what they were trying to do in the first place.
Could be.
But we don't know. Well, let's go to a quick commercial break here on the show, and we'll be back with more after this.
Hello, this is Tony Sobrado, social scientist and theorist on conspiracy theories. You are listening to Radio Freethinker. You can listen to the show by subscribing to iTunes. And I hope you enjoy your skeptical discussions and debate.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker here on CITR. So, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, there's lots of controversy going on in the freethought community. One source of that controversy is Sam Harris. For those of you who don't know, Sam Harris is one of the so-called four horsemen of New Atheism, written some number of key books, The End of Faith, Letters to the Christian Nation. So he's been something of a, agitator, so to speak. He's been up there with Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and such, in terms of drawing attention to himself and the causes of atheism and the freethought community. But now people are asking, well, is Sam Harris a racist? And that's because he wrote an article called In Defense of Profiling, a rather controversial piece that states, quote, "We should profile Muslims or anyone who looks like he or she could conceivably be Muslim, and we should be honest about it." So what he's talking about, of course, is the always aggravating trip to the airport. You go through security. And he's drawing up a dichotomy in his article of what he calls security theater. So the process where, you know, infirm grandmas and grandpas are patted down and searched, treated like criminals, or where little children are taken from their parents and scanned or waved or whatever, searching for bombs and weapons happens these days. And he sets that against what he considers the overtly PC ignoring of real threats, which he perceives as Muslims. So he asks people, after posting like videos and pictures of old ladies being searched and some in wheelchairs and on dialysis machines and such, and he asks, who here is more likely to be a terrorist, this old woman or this man in his mid-20s who's a Muslim? And this has prompted a major backlash in the freethought community. And so we're going to go over some of the points of his article, some of the criticisms, and sort of discuss it for the rest of the show. And I wanted to mention one that comes from John Shook, who is a CFI advisor and writer, etc. He wrote an article about this whole thing, and he made some pretty serious accusations about Sam Harris. He's suggested that Harris has a long history of Islamophobia, that he's been a closet bigot for a long time. Now, I mean, those are pretty extreme, but he did break down what Harris's argument was perceived to be. So I'm going to give you a bit of information on that. So he suggests that it's like this. Premise one, I see all the wrong people getting screened by the TSA. Premise two, among the right people to screen are the real potential terrorists. Conclusion, the TSA should specially screen everyone who could conceivably be Muslim. Now, Shook argues that this is not a logical argument and require the following changes so it would make sense as an argument. So he proposes it would be premise one, I see all the wrong people getting screened at the TSA. Premise two, among the right people to screen are the real potential terrorists. Premise three, new one, suicidal terrorism is an overwhelmingly Muslim phenomenon. Premise four, also new, ethnicity, gender, age, nationality, dress, traveling companions, behavior in the terminal, and all outward appearances indicate a person's beliefs. Premise five, determining a person's beliefs is a reliable way to evaluate terrorist potential. And conclusion, the TSA should screen everyone who conceivably be Muslim. Now, after that change, Shook argues that this structure may make logical sense, but now it's completely untrue because, you know, suicidal terrorism is not overwhelmingly a Muslim phenomenon. So this leaves us with some interesting questions here. Personally, when I looked at what Harris writes, he seems to have created this false dichotomy. First suggesting that the level of invasive security currently used by the TSA does any good, regardless of who it's directed at, I think is silly, but let's never mind that for now. But he basically is suggesting that it's a waste of resources to be searching non-threatening folks when it could be directed at more likely targets. And these are the only two options he presents. He doesn't offer any other solution. It's either, look, you waste time searching grandma and grandpa, or we can stop being politically correct and search that guy who looks brown.
Well, I think, and I'm gonna for the moment play devil's advocate and maybe defend Harris a little bit here. So please don't burn down my house. This is not me so much speaking. But you're right, because you say one of the premises he's dealing with is enhanced security stops terrorist attacks. And if you accept that as a premise, I'm not sure if the rest of it, at least in parts, is as extreme as you make it sound like. So, I mean, the first thing he kind of talks about is what he calls anti-profiling. That is essentially to trust security officers to know when someone is obviously not a risk. Now, you know, as you mentioned, and this is anecdotal evidence, so I think as a skeptic he's failing here, but let's go with it for a moment. When he mentions, you know, the elderly infirm couple, toddlers, they seem harmless. So, I mean, okay, so let's stop with doing Muslims. Let's just go with this sort of anti-profiling. Don't we think at least we can give him a pass on that, that maybe anti-profiling seems a valid thing? So, now I'm going to switch hats now. It does seem to make sense on the surface, but there are two big problems, I think, with this. One, once you start giving people a pass, they will be the people, willing or not, who will be the instruments of terrorists. By checking everyone, you don't leave them, in quotes, an obvious tool. So, and actually Sam Harris does address this in his second article a little bit, where he says, well, you know, it's not like grandma's suddenly going to become a jihadist. And that might be true, and she might not even be convinced, but if you put a gun to someone's head and you say, listen, if you don't take this package onto this plane, I'm going to wipe out your entire family, that might make you be willing to do it, even though you think it might be a horribly bad thing to do.
Or even just slip something into her purse. And then once you get through security, mug her, take back your gun or bomb, whatever, and then go blow up a plane.
Exactly. And the second one, and I think perhaps more of an issue, is that if you start giving some people a pass based on the hunch of screeners, someone will eventually cry foul and sue for discrimination, and they're likely to win. Because, I mean, they're, you know, it's, oh, I think this person is value and this one isn't. So I think this fails to make sense because, again, you're actually creating sort of a means for them to attack, or it's going to fail on civil rights ground. Okay, so let's go back to defending him. Secondly, what he implied, but he didn't actually say, is what I would call fuzzy profiling, or sort of profiling in broad strokes. So few terrorists are women, nor are many of them, you know, over the age of 60 or under the age of 10. Seldom are they infirm or gravely ill agents of terrorism. So what if you just limited the subjects to pat down to healthy men between, I don't know, 12 and 60 or whatever group makes rational sense? Should that be okay? Again, this strikes me as a tad arbitrary. I still think it would fail the legal challenge because, again, you know, what determines healthy or not? And it's a bit sexist. It ignores the fact that one of the sort of prize catches of the FBI was, quote, Jihad Jane, who was apparently a female terrorist. And I think, lastly, when it comes to the idea of global terrorism, it seems Muslims are the leader. In the USA, the most number of people to be killed by terrorists have been killed by Muslims. It's a fact. It's a sad fact. But now, this is not to say that all Muslims are terrorists, but again, if we are dealing with limited resources, does it not make sense to target the most likely group of people? Again, I think this one fails, and I mean, I'm trying to play up his role as good as we can. A good philosopher does that.
Sure.
Because, you know, although the press provides the appearance that Muslims are a menace, the reality is quite different. Now, first, there are a number of Muslim terrorists in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's quite often what we hear in the news. But, well, most of the people in that country are Muslims. I mean, what else would you expect? Catholic terrorists in Afghanistan? And thanks to, like, the U.S. and Israel and all that, at this particular point in history, the Middle East is one of the areas suffering most from military oppression. Thus, there's a greater impetus for change, and change under oppressive regimes, both Arab regimes and non-Arab regimes, is almost always only possible through asymmetric warfare, which is what we call terrorism.
Well, I mean, going along with that, too, is the Middle East is under major, not just occupying forces, but it's also undergoing massive civil, social, and structural changes to its civilization. I mean, some of these places, it would be generous to not call them a failed state. I mean, we're looking at some pretty bad areas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not all that unlikely to see sort of widespread violence there. So
it seems like KRS is kind of putting the blame more on the Muslim aspect and not on the other aspects like social economic forces.
Exactly. And this is, I think, is part of what you get sort of the bubble, right? Is when you get into this one train of thought, like I said, and you kind of hinted at it. If you start with the premise that enhanced security prevents terrorism, if you accept that as your premise, then a lot of other things sort of follow suit. But if your premises are wrong, your conclusions are wrong. And I think that's where Harris falls into it as his big problem. Just as an anecdote, again, the press makes you think that every terrorist in the world is a Muslim. But according to Europol, in 2010 in Europe, there were less than 250, quote, attacks. And this involved anything from burning down a cross to real sort of attacks, with over 600 people arrested and 300 convictions, and I believe only one death. Of those attacks, Ethan, guess how many of them were perpetrated by Muslims?
I'm going to guess 3.
You shouldn't be reading my notes. Yes, so only 3 of them. And actually, the vast majority were actually separatists, people like the Basques in Spain, which accounted for about 168, and leftists, not my kind of leftists, the bad kind, accounted for about 45. However, of course, this is sort of irrelevant to Harris's point, because he's thinking of the USA. Okay, so let's go to the US. In the US, the most active terror groups are actually the white supremacists, anti-abortionist, environmentalist, and sovereign citizens. By his own standards, we should be ignoring people of color and focus on white males with gun permits. I mean, there's another very weird thing that's going on in the United States right now, is this sort of, not theater of terror, but the where they create terrorists out of nothing, where the FBI will go up to someone they think is a potential terrorist, and almost exclusively they focus on Muslims. They say, hey, you have some gripe with the government, don't you? Or wouldn't you like to support your brothers? Or your life is meaningless. Wouldn't you like to give it meaningless? We're going to give you a bomb, and why don't you go plant it over there and blow up someone? And a number of these people, I mean, because there are bad people in every society, will say, sure, why not, right? I mean, I have often decried the American government for its evilness. So maybe someone might come to me and convince me that blowing up an army recruiting base would be a good thing in the grand scheme of things. And if they're not quite as smart as me, they might fall into that. But they weren't really terrorists. They were just people who potentially had a gripe for it. And that leads to another thing. So let's finish that thought. So a lot of the quote-unquote suspected terrorists or terrorist attacks in the United States weren't real terrorist attacks. They were manufactured attacks by the FBI. And in that sense, I think because they almost exclusively focus on things like Muslims, that's not a fair representation. But another thing that Sam Harris mentions, and again, we're going to talk a little bit more about this later, is the predilection, as he implies, that all Muslims are suicide bombers, that this is like one of the big things about their culture. But almost all of the attacks that supposedly happened in the United States, almost none of them were of a suicidal nature. I mean, maybe once every 3 years there's a truly suicidal. Even something like the guy who actually went nuts in the Fort Hood, who I don't think was an Islamic terrorist. I think he was someone who was realizing that he was responsible for killing his own people and couldn't handle that sort of internal angst and just snapped. I don't think he was so much suicidal as just when you snap, you do crazy things and that sort of aspect of it. So I think, I mean, on so many levels, it kind of fails. But okay, let's take one more step back. Let's say he's right. Let's just pretend he's right. If you assume what he's doing, and let's say that, you know, you're going to go with this enhanced security check. Is it really going to work? Well, the problem is that, you know, if we assume the next 9/11 is going to occur and it's going to be by very Arab people, we're looking for what? 20 people out of millions, right? Just by the law of numbers, you're not going to catch them. It has proven to be impossible because, I mean, every real sort of suicide terrorist attack in the United States has failed. And it was never actually caught by any security at all.
Well, that's, I think, pointing at the initial flaws that we saw with his basic premise that this theater of security actually does something. And I think that a lot of people, myself and you included, think that that's ludicrous, and that's not the case. But let's get to that in a bit. Why don't we take a one last quick commercial break here on the show, and we'll discuss what Harris has done after his bombshell went off. He took the criticisms he was getting and addressed some of them well, some of them very poorly, and we'll explore that next here on Radio Free Thinker. Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker, talking about Sam Harris and his controversial blog post on racial profiling. So, as I mentioned before the break, he came up with some responses to some of the criticisms that he was getting. And we're going to talk a bit about that. So, some of the criticisms that, you know, were brought up was that Harris appears to be focusing exclusively on Muslim terrorism, and the suggestion that Islam is sort of leading the pack when it comes to fundamentalist violence. And we sort of talked about that already. Now, like, I personally wouldn't deny that Islam does encourage some fundamental violence. But to say that it's at the top of the list and that everyone who practices Islam is subject to that influence seems rather silly. And that, I think, is one of the big problems with what Harris is making here, is that he assumes that every Muslim is vulnerable to the extreme fundamentalism of Islam.
Well, I think, too, again, if you do some premises up front, a lot of the stuff falls out as logical. And I think some of the ideas is his premises are just ill-conceived. I mean, like, one of the things he says in his article is that I have discovered that most secular liberals are quite unwilling to think about in detail about the threat we face from our war on terror. Well, one, what the whole concept of the war on terror is meaningless. I mean, the fact that you still believe that there is a war on terror speaks volume from your geopolitical viewpoint. Mm-hmm. In order for there to be war, you need new combatants. Are there people out there willing to do bad things to you? Yes. But it's not a war. And worsely, he's implicitly saying war on terrorism is a war on Muslims. I mean, that is the logical equivalence of what he's saying here.
Yeah.
And that sort of intolerance comes through. I just have a few quotes and that I thought were very disturbing in some ways. So he also says, if Muslims' vicious intolerance of civil discourse causes you to profile them at airports, well, someone who would not have otherwise thought to kill you will grow more insular and radicalized, and in the end, they will kill you. The point being in that one is that he's saying that Muslims are viciously intolerant to civil discourse. I mean, he says that in his article, and one of the reasons why he says that people were condemning him for his article is you don't want to get the Muslims upset, because if you do, they will kill you. And he makes points that they will kill you over anything. They will kill you. They will kill you. They will kill you. And again, that is not a good skeptic in my books.
Well, I mean, the thing that I found interesting, sort of along those lines, is someone else who criticized him was Chris Stedman, who is a gay, atheist, interfaith activist. And he gave him a list of sort of secular Muslim authorities. And Harris, like, looked through some of these links, and he finds one, and he says, to quote, within, like, the first 45 seconds, he finds a section on the website talking about Muslim moderation in terms of apostates, saying that they should be killed if he or she speaks publicly against the faith. So, I mean, to say that Harris is totally off base, that there are radical elements within Islam, is not true. There are. We know there are. We've seen people murdered, executed for saying bad things about Islam. But it's this notion that Harris has to take this radical element and broad brush, apply it to everybody in the Muslim faith is very strange. And I just don't. I think he's got tunnel vision. Like, he can't see past it.
Well, and actually, just to emphasize that point, in response to his I don't think it was Sam Harris's response to the gay friend, but someone else who responded to him had mentioned that wear a T-shirt stating "There is no God and I am gay" in an Islamic country and port back to me on your experience. And Sam Harris says this may seem like a cheap shot, but it isn't, implying, of course, that you will be stoned or killed or beat up. Well, I would say, you know, if you try that very same thing in Uganda, Kenya, or Malawi today, the exact same thing would happen. And these are predominantly Christian countries. And the idea, again, I mean, I am one to say religion makes things worse, and it does. But that does not equate to saying Islam only makes things worse. We're dealing with a radical group of people that do these things. And in his case, he's trying to tar and feather the entire populace. And worse than that, I mean, he's implicitly not saying Muslim, because let's remember here, how do you determine someone is Muslim? I mean, they don't have a tattoo on the front of their head. He's actually saying, if you are an Arab, then you are more at a risk. And he, of course, if you dig down a bit deeper, he would implicitly say, well, I also mean other people. In fact, he does say, if you're a Muslim white American, you're even more of a risk than others.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was the whole thing. Like, he's not just saying the TSA should check your see which holy book you're carrying. He's basically saying anyone who conceivably looks Muslim. And he made this kind of really sort of bad point about, but I also included myself in the category. And I'm like, yeah, as a joke, I mean, like, come on now, Harris.
Well, actually, didn't he confess to a felony?
Well, I mean, he says at one point, like, in his article, that he accidentally brought a loaded weapon through security somehow and found about it after the fact. Now, I mean, like, if he can't see that the so-called security theater is inadequate when somebody can bring a loaded weapon through it, something is not right here. And if you go through the article, because he's written another one responding to his critics, and he goes through on basically a point-by-point basis trying to point out where everybody else thinks he's wrong and then responding to it. We don't really have time to go through that right now, but there are a few other points that we can make about this. You know, a good example would be, we talk about pedophilia in the Catholic Church a lot, right? Now,
suspiciously a lot, but
yeah. Anyway, when we talk about it, how do we phrase that conversation? Do we make it sound like it's the current structure, organization, and doctrine of the Church that makes a pedophilia more likely to occur and less likely to be caught? So I would say that we do. But we don't imply that Catholics in general, as a whole, are more likely to be pedophiles.
No, actually, and remember, because of our ignorance as sort of Westerners, for lack of a better word here, is the true analogy would be saying, if you are a Christian, then you are more likely a pedophile. Because again, we tend to think of Islam as some, you know, monolithic single entity, but it's not. They have radical sects, they have really organized, really disorganized groups, and to sort of tar and feather them all with a single brush is a misnomer. I mean, he mentions too about Islamophobia, which, he has, what is it, Aryan Harris Ali, which is one of these people who are calling, you know, the 9/11 mosque, you know, the terror mosque, and, you know, and all that. I mean, one thing he claims, well, look it, I have a black friend, and they say it's okay for me to do this. Ali is an apostate. She comes from a Muslim background, although I don't think she herself is Arabic. I think she's African.
Yeah.
But again, just to sit there and say, listen, I have a Jewish friend who agrees with me about the Holocaust doesn't mean you can be a Holocaust denier. You know, it seems like a weak thing. And the people that he's associating with, which I find ironic, are exactly the racist people. I mean, the people you don't want to mention who are on your side are people like this, are Kurt Wilder, who say you should burn every Quran in the place. Bibles are okay. I mean, their message is innately racist in a religious sense as well as an ethnic sense.
And the thing that bothers me about his connection to Ali, the woman you're mentioning, is she's got a very difficult background. Like, she was in a very abusive situation. And that's not to take anything away from what she's written, because she's made some valid points, but she is not someone who can be objective about this. She's got a lot of emotional background with this. And she's not an authority in the sense that you can say, oh, well, she agreed with me. She's on the far right. I mean, like, she's right about some things, and she's got some valid points, and she's got a very sad story. But, I mean, she's so emotionally entrenched that, of course, she's on your side. She's got a huge axe to grind.
If he had got the imam who was supporting the Cordova Mosque, actually not Park 51 Mosque, mm-hmm. if he had said, well, listen, I talked to this guy, and this guy says, yes, it's great. And he kind of does imply he's got a letter from someone who is supposedly sort of a moderate who says, listen, I want to fly safe like everyone else, and if that means I got to stand in line for an hour and you don't, I'm willing to pay that price for a safer air flight. Again, I mean, that would have been a much better thing for him to brought up. This person, we have to assume he has at the end, is like that. But
again, assuming that the security theater actually works, he should have proved that point first then, if he's going to make that argument.
Well, he tries to, because one of the things that people have brought up often is Israel, which of any country in the world that can claim that it is in a war on terror, it has the most valid claim. I think it has the most valid reason to be in that war for its own reasons, but that's a whole other issue. But Israel itself, its own military, state the fact that it uses behavioral profiling. That's how it does it. If someone seems nervous, they're probably up to something wrong and worth a thing. Harris makes a point to one news article that says, no, this one guy says, we did racial profiling all the time. And again, anecdotal evidence. I mean, it seemed like a very cop-out attempt to prove your point. And when I first read the first article, I said, okay, here's Sam Harris, quite willing to confront an issue in the United States. Again, if you accept sort of some of the premises, which weren't radical premises, wrong, but not radical, this does kind of follow, and let's go with that argument. But then he released the second sort of defending his first one, and I can't help but feel he's digging himself a deeper, deeper ditch. I admire the fact that he's not shrieking back from this and saying, sorry I said anything, or let's move on to something else. But at the same time, it becomes so much harder and harder to say, here, this is someone who should be one of the four horsemen. And I always wondered how he became one of the horsemen to begin with, but timing's everything, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends on when your book comes out, I guess. But you're right. I mean, like, it'll be interesting to see what response he gets. He has one more article pending, I believe, on this subject. And depending on what position he takes and how he bases the feedback he's getting will depend. Like, some of the feedback that he's gotten, I think, is also kind of ridiculous. I mean, there's some really, I mean, we use the term sort of confrontationalist and accommodationalist. It's not a very good term. It's actually kind of decisive. But he's gotten a lot of flack from the so-called accommodation side, who are, you know, let's be friends and respect everybody and, you know, all that crap and stuff. So, I mean, some of that stuff is garbage. But he's gotten a lot of feedback that really calls him out. And he has to respond to that in at least some meaningful way, or he's going to become one of those people in the skeptical movement that we kind of go, let's not invite him to our conference anymore.
Well, and you know, that may happen, because, I mean, there's some other subtlest things in here. I mean, like, the image he uses for this particular blog post is the remains of the Twin Towers. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the implicit message here is, if you don't listen to me, this is going to happen every day, right? And two, and we kind of had a bit of a discussion about this, and Ethan, you will correct me on this, but he says, well, you know, here's sort of what I think are about 7 or 8 points that my opponents are saying. And then he essentially says, they're wrong, I'm right. Right.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, he kind of goes, I think, like, points like 6 and 7 are mildly valid or something. But, I mean, like, that's the point, though. It's just that he's making the wrong argument. He starts out by talking about security theater. Then he jumps into this ludicrous position that all Muslims are secret terrorists. And he tries to defend these two premises by jumping back and forth and making all these really weird assumptions. It's so strange.
Well, so, and it qualifies as dogmatic in my books because, again, he's doing it in spite of the evidence. I mean, yeah. If you take a look at the top 10 most wanted list in the American books, there are, I think there's one person of Arabic descent on it. All of them, like I say, are your militia people, your white supremacists. You know, if America has a terrorist issue, it's with these sort of radical groups, not with Islam. Yeah. Now, if you're in Afghanistan, as I say, of course it's going to be Muslims who are the terrorists because they're what everyone is around there.
Mm-hmm. And he keeps plotting out these examples of secular Muslims who have, you know, said something secular and have had, you know, fatwas and murder attempts on their lives. Like, this is proof that all of Islam is terrible. And it's just like, dude, like, how many branches of Christianity are there? There's probably like 56 or something, some ridiculous number. You can't imagine that there are people in Islam who maybe don't agree with each other?
Well, and that ignores the fact that, I mean, how many abortion doctors have been killed? Right? How many have had their threats? How many have been bombed?
Yeah.
Right? So you're right. There have been some people who have said that Muhammad is a bad pedophile or something, right? And someone has threatened their life. And I think because it's a Muslim threat, they get more attention than they rightly deserve. But for every one of those, I'm sure you can point to 1,000 abortion doctors who've been phoned up and says, I hope you burn in hell. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill your children. That sort of hatred. So, I mean, it's not a uniquely Muslim thing. And I don't even think, at least in the United States, it's a majority thing in the remotest context.
Yeah. Okay, well, that was a frank discussion on Sam Harris. And we hope he'll come on the show and explain himself someday.
Exactly.
Yeah, that'll happen real time soon. Anyway, we're pretty much out of time here on Radio Freethinker, so let's go to our skeptical highlights.
I have two highlights today, and they're both actually Philosopher Cafe forums. One is going to be held at the White Rock Central Library, May 9th at 7 p.m., free admission, where moderator Charlie Marxer ponders the nature and origins of empathy. So why should you care? Find out and be empathetic with your fellow human beings.
Hmm.
The other one is at the Gathering Place in Port Coquitlam, May 14th at 7 p.m., also free. It's about hate speech and the criminal code, something I like a lot. Dr. Graham Frost asks if the prohibition on hate speech damages free speech provision of our Constitution or if it protects minority rights and contributes to a flourishing society.
Interesting.
Yes, it could be. And again, apropos of considering our Jesus t-shirt, and at what point do we have to suppress people's free speech, and not the t-shirt, but even the proselytizing? I mean, that's an issue all unto itself.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, if you enjoyed our conversation today and you want to extend that conversation in your social life, consider attending Skeptics in the Pub, one of Vancouver's recurring skeptical events. It's happening on May 15th. 7:30 p.m., but you can show up anytime you like. At the Railway Club, 579 Dunsmuir Street in Vancouver downtown. And lots of friendly folks there who want to talk about skepticism, critical thinking, whatever, have a drink, have some food. Great time will be had by all, so tune in for that as well.
Excellent. I hope to be there.
Me too. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
Bye-bye, folks.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite endurance.
I'm not very good at singing songs, but here's a try.
Space. Some the sky calls to us, if we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelationships of the awesome machinery of nature.
I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos, in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky.